That's true.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Thursday, the 30th of March, and it's a pleasure to have you all here. We are going to spend the bulk of today's meeting talking about mining and the Right to Mine bill. But before we do that, we have a couple of work sessions we want to get through. Senator Hansel is here to answer any questions we might have about the amendments to this bill. So, Bill, you want to just come up? And so I'm going to open a work session first on Senate Bill 372. These are deer bills. Deer bill is bringing the deer bills, you may recall.
That was bad. Sorry. That was really bad.
What does the first one do, Beth? Oh, yeah. Okay. Why don't you just remind us what this bill is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 372 has a -2 amendment that would specify that the wildlife salvage permit is for the purpose of using game meat for human consumption and prohibit the issuance of a permit for an animal that's killed under the humane euthanasia statute. There is minimal fiscal, no revenue impact. Currently, there is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Senator Olson.
He doesn't want to talk about them?
Well, first, open the bill.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We're going to do these first?
Yeah.
Chair Dember, I move to adopt the -2 amendment dated 3/15/17.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved the -2 amendments dated March 15/17. Bill?
Thank you, Chairman Dembrough. Basically, what we did after we had the original hearing, I tried to take the concerns and issues that the members of the committee had raised. Also, ODF&W, we began to meet. I met with Senator Olson and others, and then with ODF&W, and the two amendments. They asked for the inclusion for human consumption into the bill, which we did. That's ODF&W. We removed the language that says ODF&W is not liable for any damages and put in the state of Oregon. That came from OSP. They wanted to have it broader. It was so that they thought any agency would not be held liable. I will say this. We're happy to do that. Through our research to other states, there isn't any other state that we could find that has that kind of a liability clause, but they're more than willing to do it. So, and then there was conversation regarding what to do with an animal that's hit but not killed by a car. And this amendment states the individual is allowed to humanely euthanize that animal and continue with the salvage procedure protocol. Great. So those are the amendments. I think they meet I'm happy with them, and hopefully so is the committee.
Discussion?
I guess I'll do one.
Okay.
That clearly means, though, if that happened, for example, they hit the deer or the whatever, and they knew it was going to die, so they humanely put it out, they couldn't keep it for their human consumption, right?
Yes, this bill would allow that.
It would be allowed for them to keep it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. The dilemma that we had was that if you wanted to salvage the meat, then you had to wait until the animal expired.
Right.
And there'd be a lot of pain and suffering. If you... very few people would ever want to do that, but if you eliminated it, if you euthanized it, then you just had to leave it there to rot. You couldn't
That's
use
true.
It. So we tried to make it down. It had to be hit on a road by a car, then you could do that. So we're trying to limit the poaching capabilities of doing it, but it just didn't seem humane to allow the animal to continue to suffer simply because you couldn't salvage it. So,
yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you. Senator Hansel, I just want to clarify, you said hit on a road by a car. Would that also include a truck, or is it any motorized vehicle?
Any vehicle. Good point.
I'm following that up.
Pardon?
Yes.
I'll follow up that comment. So, you can go hunting by truck?
No.
No,
it does not.
No,
a vehicle. Any vehicle.
Any vehicle. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Sorry.
Just want to make clear.
Yeah, you're right. My mistake.
Yeah. No any problem. Vehicle?
Not a motor vehicle. No. You see the bike and the
an airplane. Bike, yeah, if you hit that deer on a bike.
Yeah. I think he'll be euthanizing me.
That's right.
Who's being served?
Yeah. Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Anybody have any objection to our adopting these dash two amendments? Seeing none, the motion carries. Vice Chair?
Chair Dimbro, I move Senate Bill 372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee of Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion of the main motion?
Just a question as to why it was rescinded, because of they removed any?
Yeah, it has a minimal fiscal.
Okay.
Okay, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries.
I think Brzezinski wanted to carry this one.
I think I'll let Senator Hansel carry it. Okay, so I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 372, open our work session on Senate Bill 373, and this is the deer population control bill, right?
Urban deer.
Urban.
Yes. From Joseph.
Right. Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and do the motion?
I thought you'd discuss it, or at least let us know what it
is. We don't have any amendments?
We do.
We do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do the amendments.
Okay, Beth, tell us what the amendments are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a dash one amendment that would require a city to first adopt an ordinance, resolution, or order declaring that deer populations have risen to levels that constitute a public nuisance prior to petitioning the department for assistance in reducing those populations. There's a minimal fiscal, no revenue impact, and again, there's currently a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Dimbro, I move to adopt the dash one amendment dated 3/7/17.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the dash one amendments dated March 7, 2017. Bill, I think we've, Senator Hansel, we've just heard what those amendments do. Anything you want to add to that?
Unless there's any questions, the clarification was that we want to work with the department, not the commission, so we changed that. They wanted to, if they're unable to market the hides and the antlers over a period of time, they didn't want the hides, but they wanted the antlers back, so we accommodated that. They made it very clear, city has to take proactive initiative to begin the process. If they don't, then ODF is involved. The other thing I might mention, too, there was some discussion about how do you euthanize deer. We did some further research. ORS 166.220 already allows Wildlife Services to remove firearms humanely within city limits, so they can legally discharge it. So we didn't have to address that issue. They have that authority now under this bill would allow them to do that. So I think we're good.
Okay, great. Discussion?
Yeah.
Yes, Vice Chair.
I wonder, Senator Hansel, does this bill relate to the urban vehicular hunting license that you just passed?
I hope not. That goes with the Humvee that's on parade.
That's right.
And do we?
Yes.
If we put the two bills together, if I hit the deer in the city, can I shoot it, or do I have to call someone to come get it, and or do I have to drag it across the city lines before I take care of finishing it off?
Don't answer that question.
No. Let's give him the opportunity.
If you're driving fast enough to hit a deer in the city.
Does it matter if it's the left lane or the right lane?
If you're going 77 miles an hour in the left lane in a city, I'm sure you would.
Senator Hansel, I would just say when you carry these bills on the floor, I would be prepared.
Yeah, this is just the warm-up.
Remember my raccoon bill.
Okay.
A very good bill, by the way.
It was very good.
It was a very good bill.
Is there any further discussion? Okay, is there any objection to our adopting the dash one amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Dimbrough, I move Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Senator, this may be the third bill this week that I've lightened the load of Ways and Means for you.
Thank you.
Is there any objection to this bill?
Only that I not have to carry or any member of the dais have to carry the bill.
Okay, seeing no objection, so ordered, the bill will go to the floor and Senator Hansel will carry.
If I may say one thing in conclusion, Chair Dimbrough, I really appreciate the input from the committee in all seriousness because I think your input made a better bill. There were things that we hadn't thought of, required us to also work with the department, and I think we got a better bill. And I was thinking, since Senator Bertschiger isn't here, maybe he could carry the bill. No, I'll be happy to.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I did notice on the bill, though, that it was sponsored by Jacques Auto Body in Athena, Oregon.
And I am still awesome. It's going to be so good to talk about urban deer.
Okay, colleagues, I am pleased to close the work session on Senate Bill 373. And let us open our public hearing on Senate Bill 644. So, Beth, you want to tell us about this?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 644 has a -3 amendment that replaces the original measure. The -3 amendment defines mining and specifies that county approval of a land use application for mining on exclusive farm use lands is not subject to statutory standards or land use rules in Baker, Grant, Harney, Lake, Malheur, Union, and Wallowa counties. It makes some legislative findings related to mining and addresses causes of action for nuisance or trespass against operators of surface mines.
Okay, thank you, Beth. Okay, I'm going to bring up Rich Angstrom and Dave Honeycutt. Is there anyone else you'd like on this panel? Rich. Okay, gentlemen, if you could tell us what you're trying to do with this bill.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Mining Association, here in support of the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 644. A little bit of background. In 2015, the legislature adopted House Bill 3089. It had a mining policy statement that provided that mining was an important natural resource use for the state of Oregon. And it also directed DOGAMI to prepare a mineral resource potential study for southern and eastern Oregon. And I had that mineral resource potential study that DOGAMI produced in September 2016. Put on OLIS, so it should be in your on the OLIS on your meeting materials for this particular bill. To no one's surprise, DOGAMI came back and indicated that there is significant mineral resource potential in southern and eastern Oregon. Again, that didn't surprise anyone. If you look to our neighbor to the south, the state of Nevada. Nevada has a very long and rich history of mining, and the geology in northern Nevada is essentially the same as it is in southern Oregon, especially southeastern Oregon. Nevada, and there is a PowerPoint presentation that you'll also find on OLIS from the Nevada Mining Association. I'd urge you to take a look at that as well. There's quite a few slides on it, but there's some really good information on the impact that mining has, large-scale mining has in the state of Nevada. Mining contributes 3.3% of that state's GDP, 4.9% of all taxes paid to the state's general fund come from the mining industry in Nevada. And the average wage, and this is really important for the seven counties that we're talking about here with this, with Section 1 of the -3 amendments, the land use piece, the average wage in Nevada for the mining industry is $96,000 a year. That's three times the median wage in those southeastern Oregon counties. So if we could figure out how to incorporate what Nevada's doing and encourage that industry to come to the parts of our state that have never recovered from the 2008 downturn, I would say that we should have a party in the Capitol for doing so, because we're creating jobs in a part of the state that really desperately needs it. Nevada does all of that and all of those statistics and the benefits to both the private sector and the public sector in Nevada come from only 119 mines. So this isn't a, you know, it's a important industry in Nevada, but it's the numbers that are being produced on a very small number of mines. We would, with the amendments that we're talking about in the Dash 3 amendments to 644, we'd never come close to 119 mines in Oregon. But even a few, as we'll get into, even a few large-scale mines would do wonders for that particular part of the state. There are... And I've submitted a letter. Oregon Mining Association has submitted a letter, again, on OLIS that details out the requirements, the hoops that a mine site applicant in Oregon would have to jump through. So I'm not going to go into them in great detail. But there are essentially three kinds of permits that a miner would have to go through in order to permit a site. Two, maybe three, depending on whether or not you're looking to go onto federal land or not. The first one, and this is for a large-scale mine. These aren't the types of – this is entirely different from what you've been talking about with Senate Bill 3. This is large-scale mining. The first application that you'd have to satisfy is a consolidated application. You can find that in Chapter 571. That's the mining chapter of the statutes. In order to obtain a consolidated application, that's your state permit. In order to obtain that consolidated application, the miner would have to demonstrate that they comply with all federal laws. They'd have to get permits from DOGAMI, DSL, Water Resource Department. There are five separate DEQ permits, permits from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. There's an environmental rule and compliance statute. It's 517-956 that the ODF&W is in charge of. That's where you would get your sage-grouse issues resolved in those seven counties. The mining applicant, actually DOGAMI, is required to prepare a socioeconomic and an environmental impact study, which, of course, the applicant would end up paying for. So there are a multitude of permits to address all of these specific environmental concerns, the wildlife impact, cultural resources issues, aesthetic issues. All of that is done through the consolidated application permitting process. It's very thorough. And what we like best about it is the decisions are made by people with expertise in the subject matter. They're agency folks that are making those decisions. They're not folks on the local land use end. If we're on federal land, all or a part of our application is on federal land, we have to get a plan of operations approved from BLM. A BLM, BLM will coordinate with DOGAMI and through the consolidated application process, and I believe in the one application we've had, the consolidated application statutes were adopted in 1991. In the 26 years since they've been adopted in Oregon, we've had one application. It's pending right now. It's for a mine site about 20 miles southwest of Vail. On that application, I believe that DOGAMI has entered into a memorandum of understanding with BLM, because that application has both federal land components and private land components. So as part of the BLM plan of operations requirement, we have to demonstrate and satisfy all the requirements of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, the FLTMA, the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. We have to do an environmental impact statement through NEPA. So all of the same issues that are addressed in the state application process also get addressed in the federal application process. So that both the state and the federal application processes for a large-scale mine are very thorough. We then get, unfortunately, to I think what is the block for encouraging out-of-state folks to come into Oregon, and that's the local land use process. Mining is allowed in Oregon in EFU zones, and when we're talking about Eastern Oregon large-scale mines, as the committee, I'm sure, is aware, having heard me talk about this and others on the land use side, once you get outside of cities in Oregon, everything or almost everything out there, both public and private land, is going to be zoned for either exclusive farm use or forest use. So the kinds of mine sites that we're talking about in Eastern Oregon will, especially in Southeastern Oregon, will almost exclusively be zoned for exclusive farm use. It's not that there are, if we had an exclusive mining zone, that would be great. The problem is, since mining is since the deposits are subsurface, you don't know exactly where to put the exclusive mining zone until you go out and actually explore. So we're going to be on EFU land for the most part. 215-283 is the statute that allows uses on exclusive farm use land, and mining is allowed as what's known as a sub 2 use. It's 215-283, sub 2, sub B, sub B. When you have a sub 2 use, for this is inside baseball and land use, and I apologize to the committee, but when you have a sub 2 use on farmland, the counties are free to impose additional criteria. You have a land use permit approval requirement under 215-298. That's unique to mining and not the other types of uses. We have to satisfy a significant impact test for farm and forest practices under 215-296 with essentially subjective criteria. And we have a Goal 5 analysis. Mining is regulated by LCDC under Statewide Planning Goal 5. That's the natural resources goal. We have to demonstrate that we have a significant mine. And, of course, the rule does not define what significant is, meaning the county can make that choice on their own, and there really isn't anything that we can do about it. They could say we're significant or they could say we aren't. And we have to go through what's known as an ESEE analysis, the non-aggregate mineral folks. And, of course, that has essentially subjective criteria. There is very little on the land use planning side regulating filling out the requirements for a non-aggregate mine. So essentially we're making law as we go along. The problem with all of that is there are subjective criteria. They're made, and we've got a complicated application that really is based on science. We've satisfied all of our requirements for a consolidated application. We can satisfy all the requirements for a plan of operations through BLM. We satisfy all federal law. And now we're stuck into a land use process with complicated issues and subjective criteria, and we don't have experts making the final decision on whether or not we're approved or not. And those of you who have been to a local land use hearing at midnight while they're still talking about it know exactly what I'm talking about. For the large-scale mining folks, that's a problem. We can't take that risk of putting our application into such a subjective process. And so you understand, the exploration costs alone for a large-scale mine are significant. You take core samples, and a core sample is basically you are drilling through rock. The core samples can go anywhere from 300 to 1,000 feet plus. The hole that they make is about this big, and you take a drill and you drill through solid rock. When you do a core sample, the average cost is about $100,000 a sample. What we have for the one mine application that we have in the state of Oregon, they have drilled 400 core samples. 400 core samples at $100,000 a piece is $40 million. So they have sunk $40 million into their exploration costs before they even submit an application. If we expect there are very few people that have the capital to sink $40 million into exploration costs before they even submit an application. If we expect folks to come into the state and spend that kind of money to do that kind of investigative work to determine whether or not there's a significant deposit, they need to be assured that if they comply with their state and federal requirements that they can get a permit, and we can't do that right now. That brings me to Section 1 of the amendments. What we're trying to do with Section 1, and I want to emphasize to the committee that how narrow the Section 1 amendments are. The Section 1 amendments talk about large-scale mines, and they define large-scale mines. A 500,000-ounce gold deposit, which the standard we use is 500,000 ounces, that may be a little bit high. We may want to back down on that number a little bit. But a 500,000-ounce gold deposit in today's dollars is a $615 million deposit. We have so we're not talking about small mines. We are talking with these amendments about large mines. If you had a large mine on EFU land only, we're not talking about forest land here, just EFU, and it's not aggregate. These amendments exclude the dash one or the section one land use piece excludes aggregate applications, and it's at least 1 mile from a city, so we don't have create a disturbance for folks inside town. Then we would, under this bill, have a very truncated local land use process. We're not trying to change any of the requirements for our state consolidated application. We're not trying to change any of the requirements for our plan of operations with BLM. You couldn't do that anyway. It's a federal issue. But we would have a very truncated land use process to enable the local governments to make sure that we had that they had road capacity, that we weren't creating problems for planes with the birds that would conceivably increase bird activity resulting from the reclamation pond, and that we weren't we were taking care of health and safety issues for for any residents around the mine site, which there probably aren't going to be any because we'll be out in the middle of nowhere. The point to all of you is this, and I'm sorry for going on so long, but the point to you, to all of you, is this. If we had Intel or Nike in Hillsboro that wanted to put in a new plant and create a bunch of jobs, we would come, the legislature would take steps to help them. The local government would take steps to help them. We'd get what they needed to get so that they could get their permits and we could get the jobs the building sited and the jobs created, and everyone would go down for the ribbon cutting ceremony and get their picture taken. We're not going to have an Intel plant or a Nike plant in Baker County. There's no infrastructure and no people. So that's not a use that we're going to get there. But what I would submit to you is a $615 million large-scale metal mine in Baker County is the Intel or the Nike for that county. Creates jobs, puts people to work, contributes to the state, contributes to the county. Why would we not do whatever we could to encourage that kind of use in that county? That's what we're trying to do with the Dash 3 amendments. I've talked about Section 1. Mr. Angstrom can finish up. And I apologize for going so long. I thank you, Mr. Chair, for holding this hearing, and I urge you to help Eastern Oregon and adopt these amendments and move this bill along.
That was a very thorough presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Rich Angstrom, President of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. Just a couple of quick details to follow up on Dave's testimony, and I'll jump right to the other sections of the bill. The one thing I wanted to say on that last point Dave was making is these jobs are typically $60,000 to $90,000 a year jobs, and in Eastern Oregon, these mining jobs are significant income jobs for those areas. The other thing I would point out is look at how we look at the one cement company that's mining in eastern Oregon and how that we spend so much time trying to protect that, the 126 jobs in that particular county. It's one of the biggest employers. And so that gives you some kind of other ideas how important these few, there would always just be a few, mine sites would be to those economies as we try to jumpstart and do something for the rural county, those rural communities. The other issue I did want to point out is on the threshold. We set it at 500,000 ounces, as Dave said, it's $650 million income. That's a pretty substantial business. That may not using ounces may not work for things like lithium and chromium and other kinds of things that are measured in tons. So we're thinking about what the right level threshold for that is, and it could be a monetary threshold, a job threshold. So, you know, we're open to having a conversation, so we dial in what's a significant large-scale mine site. And in this case, the 500 ounces works for sure for gold, silver, and platinum, but it probably doesn't work for a lot of the other minerals that were identified, not just by Dogami, but also by USGS, also did a companion study or a parallel study, I should say, that also pointed out Oregon's rich mineral potential. So I'm going to pick up the nuisance protection, nuisance trespass protection sections, and those are sections 3 and 4. The background for this is there's sections in the statute already about the right to farm and forest, the miners across the state have thought a lot about just adding mining to those protections and have the same kind of nuisance and trespass protections under those statutes as both the farm and forest interests have. But after talking with folks about that approach, we thought that that probably wasn't a good approach for a variety of legal reasons, and that maybe mining should be separate from the protections that the farm folks have and the forest folks have. One is that we're extremely regulated industry. As Dave literally went through, I can't even tell you the dozens of permits that we have to go through for just both the feds, the state, and the local governments in order to get one of these sites through. But the first concept we have, with that said, is basically creating an affirmative defense for miners that are within their permit conditions. They have to be totally within their permit conditions, and if they are, then they have protection from the nuisance or a trespass suit. And our thinking on that is for a lot of reasons. One is it sends, I think, a clear message to miners all over the state that if you come to Oregon, we'll protect you in some fashion as long as you're lawfully operating. But the second part of that is that if we're outside of our permit conditions, then you are not, our folks are not protected. The suits would move forward. So what we're trying to do is kind of quiet the temperature down over the issues around mining in the state, provide a message, a broader message that will protect people, and we do it in a very narrow perspective, and that is basically creating an affirmative defense if somebody does sue one of our miners, and if they're within their permit conditions, they're protected. Here's a couple of examples, and they're a little bit different. So nuisance, when you think about a nuisance suit, what you're really thinking about from a mining perspective is the noise issue that the mine might have to be emitting while it's doing its mining operations. That can come from crushing and, you know, all kinds of things that the miners might be doing. We have to follow DEQ's noise standards for sure, but things like MSHA require us to have backup beepers, which, by the way, is the biggest complaint. And why do we have backup beepers on our equipment? Because we're trying to save miners' lives. It's straight safety issue required by the feds that we have to comply. And if we get a nuisance suit over something like that, and we say, hey, look, it's a backup beeper, they require us to do that, and we're following the obligations of the federal government on that, we should be protected from a backup beeper. On the issue of trespass, it can come in from dust or groundwater or something of that nature that's just leaving the property. And again, with DEQ, we have dust standards, and in the case of groundwater, we have water resource standards, we have Dogami standards, which are very robust. And I'm not going to go through all of those, but I got basically the analysis right here, which would take about the amount of time Dave just went through to go through all of the regulations for both dust and noise. But if we're within those permit conditions set by counties or DGAMI, then we also are protected from a nuisance claim. But if we're not, we're emitting too much, we are affecting groundwater sources that are affecting other people, then we're open to those types of suits. So we think this is a small ask from the committee, from the mining community. We think it's a fair ask. And we also think not only the long-term message we send out to the broader mining community, but just with all the tension over mining in the building, we think this is a good way of just kind of protecting those miners that are doing a good job and trying to be lawful. So that's our comment on that. The last piece of this is the policy option package that we have in Section 6. DGAMI's budget has a policy option package 106, and we're trying to put that in, and it will have a fiscal, but we're trying to codify it, that continues the effort of 3089, which was the mineral identification, and have DGAMI continue going out and doing high-level mineral identification of just basically where the minerals are, not going in, like Dave said, these $100,000 holes, but continue the effort to find out where the mineral opportunities are, because it sets a stage for all this economic opportunity that we've been trying to talk, we've been talking to all of you individually about. We think it's highly important that this be included in what comes out of the legislature to promote something, some growth in our rural counties that really need it. I know in this building, sometimes mining is a dirty word for some reason, but it will create, and it has the potential of creating significant change in those economies in parts of the state that are just in dire need of some kind of economic infusion, and this is the opportunity. These mines that we have are the opportunity. Last comment. I believe, and I know you guys know, all of you know this, that I believe that the processes that we should go through should always be robust. That's Oregon's way, to have everything thought out and do a good job to protect the environment and create the opportunity. Our pitch is that it's got to be done once. And a lot of the things that we're talking to you about, and especially Dave's piece on the land use, is the multiple repetition of analyses that we go through. Just in dust, as an example, both the state and the local governments have significant bites on dust. On water, the feds, the state, and the counties have bites at the apple. And what that does is it's driving folks away from Oregon, and we're losing an opportunity. So make it robust, make it thorough, but we just need to do it one time. With that, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
I'm good.
I have a couple of questions. I'll just jump in. So, you know, in terms of the job estimates that we might be looking at, and, you know, I'm very sensitive to the argument of, you know, the need to build the economies in those parts of the state. So, I know that a lot of mining is automated these days, or more mechanized. What kind of job estimates can we expect? This. I mean, if, for example, we
both
were,
have an answer on that.
Yeah, if we were going to connect this to number of jobs as opposed to number of ounces, what's reasonable here?
I'll let Dave hit it from his side, too, because he's looked at it a little differently. But I can give you the example. It's not as automated as it's not as automated as you think, because you still have the excavators working. Those are operated by people. You still have the truck drivers. You still have all the processing plants and the mechanics that are keeping all the crushers and conveyor belts and all the heavy machinery moving. They're intense. A typical aggregate, even mid-sized aggregate site, as an example, is 30, 40 people, right? So, and there's significant family wage jobs. These things, because the processing is so much greater, have a larger human component. The one mine site that we do know about in Grassy Mountain in eastern Oregon is actually going to be underground, and it sounds like it's going to be fairly labor-intensive. Dave probably remembers the numbers they gave me. As a 50-year-old plus, I'm starting to forget some of those numbers at times. But the point is it's less automated than you think. on the threshold question, I actually think that is one of those things we should think about. Maybe instead of using an ounce amount or a ton amount, that we use a how many people are employed amount. How many jobs will it bring? We're open to that kind of conversation.
Mr. Chair, the only response I can give you is the number of jobs is entirely dependent on the size of the deposit. If we have a large deposit with a large with an extended mine life, if the mine cycle, you know, if the deposit will last 20 years, we're going to create, and it's large, we're going to create more jobs for a longer period of time. I believe, I think this is right, on the Grassy Mountain site, the one that we have, they're talking about a 20-year mine cycle and 80 full-time jobs, which in Malheur County, 80 jobs is a lot of darn jobs.
Okay, great. Yes, Senator Roper.
So, you know, people get uptight about EFU land, and we're talking about seven counties in Eastern Oregon. Do you know how many acres there are there? And what a typical mine would take up in acreage?
Well, Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I don't know the acreage, but it's a big chunk of the state, obviously.
I do.
But what I would say is I think the Grassy Mountain site's somewhere under 50 acres, if I remember. I mean, it's a small, maybe 26 is my memory.
No, I think it, well.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, there are 24 million acres of farm and forest land in the state of Oregon. The EFU land is 16 million acres. Almost all, when you get into the southeastern Oregon counties, almost all of that is going to be rangeland. So it's going to be EFU zoned, a little bit of forest, especially when you get up into Grant County and Union and Wallowa. But when you get to the southeastern Oregon and down through Lake County, that's all going to be EFU land. I believe the Grassy Mountain site is about 200 acres.
Mm-hmm. And
it's an underground.
It's underground. The exposure is small.
In that kind of place, do they have an expected how much that site is going to be worth with respect to, you know, what's coming out of it, jobs, all that kind of stuff? Do they kind of have an idea?
Chair Demarest, Senator Roblin, the answer to that is yes, they do have an idea, and I believe they're required as part of their federal financial reporting requirements to provide that information. So we can get that information for you.
So with regard to that, then, grazing land is not real valuable in comparison. It is valuable, but it's in a sense with respect to this mining. And if we have the single largest place that the state land trust for our kids, you know, Elliott Forest, a big one. The other biggest, and it's larger than that, is rangeland over in Eastern Oregon, mm-hmm. still owned by the kids. And trying to figure out value, if theirs was land that had the ability to mine, the money would then go into the money they make off it would go into the state school fund for kids. Do we have any estimate of the kinds of values that they might expect out of acres of whatever the particular material might be? I'm trying to increase the value of the money for the.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, we don't because, at least we don't, because
right.
we don't know
where
exactly where those state holdings are. I'm sure you could estimate that. The only difficulty, as I said earlier, is since minerals are subsurface, you know, the days where you could where you'd be walking along the trail with your horse and step on a gold nugget have long come and gone. I mean, the process that they're using now is they're removing. We've taken the mine tour, and if you get a chance to take the mine tour of the Grassy Mountain site, I'd urge you to do so. We were looking at core samples, and you had to get a magnifying glass out with the core sample to find the fleck of gold. That's the kind of mining, modern mining now. It's not that you're digging along and you find a big rock of gold. It's flecks in core samples.
Okay.
That particular mine site, and the committee should go look at it because it's pretty amazing, is the entrance to the site's going to be underground, is just a itty-bitty footprint. And the gold deposit actually extends down from there, and it actually was Yellowstone's geyser. that has moved across Oregon and into Wyoming. And as that geyser was moving, it was moving little bits of gold that then was sedimented in, you know, to those core samples and along those chutes. And so that's what they're doing, is they're coming in and they're going down, and the footprint is like, it's not very big from that side. The processing side probably is, the whole thing is probably pretty big, but when it's all done, you won't even see it. And we looked at what they were doing, and Representative Bence gave a presentation last year or 2 years ago on 3089, and basically just showed how the reclamation and everything is going to work on that particular mine site. And it's just phenomenal what that company is going to be able to do with no impact, hardly limited impact on the ground. So,
so we received some testimony, and I assume that we'll be hearing from subsequent speakers, but I wanted to give you a chance to answer this. The fact that, or you know, the assertion that it's very rare, if at all, for an application, you know, to local planning, to a county, to be rejected, and you know, hence this legislation may not be needed. I wonder if you could respond to that.
I can.
Are these being rejected?
Mr. Chair, I can answer that on the hard rock side. On the hard rock side, we're basically zero for zero, as I indicated earlier. In the 26 years since we've had the consolidated application statutes enacted in 1991, we've had one application. So we don't know at this point. What I can tell you is, given the ambiguities in the existing law and the requirement that we obtain a land use permit and the vagaries of the system, we've been told repeatedly, both Mr. Angstrom and I, that the large-scale mining industry won't come to Oregon. They won't come to Oregon because they don't think they can get a permit, and the ambiguities are such that they're not going to go and dump $40 million or whatever it is in exploration costs on the hope that if they discover a deposit, they can do something. We're trying to short-circuit that ahead of time so that we can go back when we go to Reno or Boise or wherever we go next winter for the next annual mining conference and tell folks, look, if you come to Oregon, we've changed the law a little bit. You still got to do all of your state and federal requirements, but we changed the law a little bit to provide you with some certainty. So that's where we're heading on that.
Mr. Chair, that sounds like related to the aggregate issue over east, and that is out of the bill. I would say that first. The second thing I would say is we do not have much problem on the east side getting aggregate, especially in those seven counties. The valley on the other side on the aggregate is very difficult, and there's been a significant number of defeats, and we've testified to those. In fact, before I came and testified here, I was just reviewing the list. But this is not an aggregate issue, and it's more oriented towards that. But what I would say is what this does is we are trying to objectify the process with clear, objective decision-making. And where we have a good relationship with our local governments all over, no matter how you cut it, mining becomes more of a political process. And this gets rid of some of that politics and keeps it into the objective decision-making that these mine sites need to go through versus the political problems that can be created from mining. Mm-hmm.
But just to clarify, your concerns here are really in anticipation of what you would expect would be, you know, a rocky road as far as the approval. And, you know, and it's the fear of that you feel is inhibiting potential investment here in the east.
Mr. Chair, I'll just talk from my side of it at the moment. I actually think it's more about the messaging to trying to get miners here. We have the minerals, but they don't want to come. And so we're trying to do some things that make it look more attractive to them for them to come. And Oregon's land use system is, you know, frankly, it's one of those issues that they look at and they see the uncertainty that's associated with it. So, I mean, from my side, the advantage of all of this is creating a law that makes it look more attractive to try to get one of the big majors to come in and say, look, we'll make the investment in Oregon.
Okay. Dave, you mentioned the sage grouse and that, yeah, you know, protections for the sage grouse would be guaranteed up front. We got something from ODF&W that expressed concern that the impact of this could be to affect the Goal 5 in such a way that sage grouse could be compromised. Mm-hmm. Is it your sense that Goal 5 would still apply to, given the regime you're trying to put forward here?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you would apply the sage grouse protection measures from Goal 5, but you would apply sage grouse protection measures, and ODF&W would be in charge of that. If you look at ORS 517-956, and I lay out the statute in its entirety in my letter, that section, as part of the consolidated application process, ODF&W is required. They loop in as part of the technical review team, and they're required to take protection measures for fish and wildlife consistent with their policies. They have signed on to the sage grouse, obviously to the sage grouse protection measures that are part of Goal 5. And in fact, one of the requirements that ODF&W requires is protective measures to maintain an objective of zero wildlife mortality. So we're not just talking about sage grouse, we're talking about all kinds of different wildlife. That's part of the consolidated application process. There's a statute further in Chapter 571 that gives ODF&W the ability to impose conditions of approval on the operating permit that DOGAMI issues that take care of those wildlife issues. So this is all reviewed, again, by the experts as part of the consolidated application process, rather than having a land use planner with little expertise in wildlife biology making that call at the local land use level.
Great. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let's move on. Let's hear from Mike Eliason and Jerome Rose. We're staying positive. Staying positive here.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, Michael Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. We held a call with the seven affected counties earlier this week. Five of the seven participated, and while acknowledging it's a challenging issue, they felt like this is a narrow enough attempt, and the challenges are well known with attracting significant industry to Eastern Oregon, that all five of the seven counties, the five that participated in our discussion, all expressed support for this concept, and we wanted to make sure we got that on the record. They obviously, there is some relinquishment of the local process. However, they felt the overall process is still robust enough that if it helped in some way to attract the mining industry to their counties, they were supportive of that and happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Mike.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Jerome Rose, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Oregon Cattlemen's Association is the voice of the cattle industry in Oregon. We represent ranchers throughout Oregon and aim to help grow Oregon's beef industry and to promote environmentally and socially sound economic practices. Oregon has over 13,000 cattle producers using 57% of the state's agricultural lands and comprising 14% of Oregon's total agricultural sector. Beef's been Oregon's largest agricultural industry for the last 3 years. Oregon OCA supports the property rights and economic opportunities for private landowners. Our policies include consideration of limitation on private property rights, and therefore we closely follow proposals on land use and Oregon's unique and sometimes challenging land use program. We support the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 644 as it will allow better flexibility of land for our members, including right for permitted mining on private property in Baker, Grant, Harney, Lake, Mahir, Union, and Wallowa counties. USGS and Dogami reports show significant mineral deposits in these seven counties that have a strong likelihood to be in economical mines. The ranching community needs the ability to be able to utilize resources on their land to diversify their income streams. The DAS 3 amendments go a long way to aiding ranchers to that end. Senate Bill 644 allows ranchers the opportunity to explore mineral opportunity on their lands. We support this step in positive direction on land use and look forward to continuing to find ways to support the economic opportunity of ranching families and rural Oregonians to have family wage-earning jobs in Eastern Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerome. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you very, very much, both of you. Okay, let's hear from a couple of agencies. Shannon Hearn and Joy Vaughn. And Ellen, you want to come up? Okay, whatever makes sense.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss Senate Bill 644 with you today. We are neutral on the bill, but we are trying to express the concerns we have around fish and wildlife impacts. I did submit brief written testimony. We were slightly trying to tailor that to the Dash 3 amendments. So just real brief, you know, our concern, the crux of it, is that if mining activity is no longer viewed by the local government as a development action because it's an outright permitted use, the mining activity may be exempt from the Goal 5 rules, which you've just mentioned. And so as a result, we wouldn't be able to review fish and wildlife impacts as thoroughly as we do now. And where greater sage-grouse plays into this and is very important is we don't think our rules would be triggered for compensatory mitigation. And there could be significant implications to the conservation efforts, including those called out in Executive Order 1518, which was really crucial into avoiding a listing decision here just a couple of years ago. So when we talk about this larger, more comprehensive process and review, we're still trying to determine our rules, the executive order, where we play into it, and whether we would still have the regulatory mechanisms in place to provide assurances that that species is going to be protected and persist. So we're happy to answer any questions, but that's the crux of the issue.
Okay, and just to clarify, so it's your sense that if it's an outright permitted use, then your role is more limited. Could you clarify that a little bit?
So I brought Joy with me today. Thanks. She's our land use coordinator, so I'm going to let her introduce herself. And
Chair Dembo and members of the committee, my name is Joy Vaughn. I'm the Land Use and Waterway Alterations Coordinator with ODFW. And we coordinate with local governments on, you know, many of their permits. And it's our understanding that, you know, if the way that the Dash 3 amendment is proposed, if it's an outright permitted use, we would lose that opportunity to provide input on avoidance or minimization of fish and wildlife habitats as we do now through our recommendations on local permits. Currently, if the mines are not triggered by a Dogami threshold and they're just locally permitted, then we could provide those comments through a conditional use permit, and we may get minimization or potentially mitigation of those impacts. So some of the concerns are if they're outright permitted, it wasn't clear to us how that would change the local process, considering both sage-grouse, but also just impacts to, you know, a wide array of fish and wildlife, and also just looking at on-site and off-site potential impacts to habitat. So just wasn't clear on how the amendments may affect kind of local review as it is now.
So my sense, you know, what we heard from Mr. Honeycutt was, you know, under the current process, there is a role for ODFW to play early on before it gets to the local level and your advice is requested. And that's where the presumably concerns about sage grouse could still come in. Is there a kind of earlier role when, you know, in those first stages of an application process?
Chair Dembro, yes and no. So, always. Right now, most of our review is triggered by either the DOGAMI or the DLCD permitting and review. So when we start talking about a package deal, if you will, that will come to the department and then the department will review it under our rules, that's where we're not able to determine how that would essentially be triggered. And if it's really relying on a new set of rules that the department then has to implement, that these applicants come to us versus through the usual process, that's kind of a new standard for us to review and see how much authority we really do have.
Okay. So we may want to have a sit down on that at some point.
Yeah, Chair Dimmer, we'd be very open to that.
Great, thanks. I'm sorry. Ellen, why don't you go ahead and give your testimony.
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ellen Miller with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Thank you for the opportunity today to talk about the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 644. I was very happy to hear Mr. Honeycutt's testimony to talk about specifically retaining a local land use decision. That is a concern of ours with the draft Dash 3 amendment as drafted. Specifically on page 3, lines 3 to 4, it states that these permits would not be subject to any administrative rule relating to land use. We're concerned that that could prohibit not only the impacts prohibit the work that needs to be done on the sage-grouse conservation effort, but also on any kind of local land use decision. So we're still looking into that. We have concerns just with that language as drafted. I want to be really clear on the sage grouse conservation efforts. This is under the executive order that Shannon mentioned. So there is the, as Mr. Honeycutt mentioned, there's the consolidated application that they do to look at the impacts and mitigation. But the what we call the SAGE-CON efforts is actually a big group of agencies and stakeholders that work together and are all put to different tasks. And this was an agreement that we came to so that we didn't get the listing a couple years back. And part of our agreement is that we're required to keep an inventory of these protected areas of concern and that there's only a portion or a 3% of those areas that are developed. So we really need to go through that local land use process to have that conversation about using up that amount of land that we do have, that 3% in those what we call PACs, protected area of concerns. I'm sure you didn't know sage grouse had a PAC, but they have a PAC. So that's really important for us. So a couple of other things I wanted to comment on. I was happy to hear that they were open, that the proponents were open to the discussion about the significant resources and what kind of putting some detail around that, what site criteria would actually make it a significant resource. So happy to be a part of that conversation. And then clear and objective standards. Absolutely. We really want to see that in local decision making on land use issues. So we're happy to have further conversations on that as well. So I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Colleagues, any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Thank you all very much. So although he didn't sign up, I see Ian Madden here. I think I'm going to ask you to come up, if you would, Ian. Just before we go into the rest of the testimony, just to say something about the consolidated permit process, just for us to get a better sense of how things are currently.
Sure. For the record, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the Deputy Director of Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'll talk to you a little bit about the two permit processes that are actually applicable here. There's been a lot of discussion of gold mines and the 500,000 ounces, and that is all covered by the consolidated permit process that Dave described fairly accurately. But there's a whole other class of mines for everything else in the world except for aggregate that are covered under a different permitting process. That's what we call our, oh gosh, I've only been at this for 4 months, so I'm going to get it wrong. Division 35, I think, rules for non-aggregate mines. And that process includes a review loop where we send the permit, completed permit, out to all the other agencies to get their comments back. And so ODF and W and DLCD would be included at that point. And then we would respond to those comments with permit conditions or with requests for more information from the applicant. And then the other portion of that particular permit process is the applicant would have to show that they have land use approval before we would write them a permit. So for that smaller or for that different class of mines, there is built into our permitting process an opportunity for issues like fish and wildlife to be addressed. A caveat to that is our statutes don't say send this to fish and wildlife and then do whatever they tell you. They're very general. And we have in practice over the years gone quite a ways towards accommodating the comments from our sister state agencies, but we are not actually specifically required in statute to do that sort of thing. The Division 37 chemical process mining permitting is really comprehensive and complicated. There's a multi-year data collection process that goes on that is designed by a technical review committee that involves all of the associated agencies. We have regular meetings to review data that's provided by the applicant. And so we're really covering all the bases very thoroughly with that process. In this particular case for Grassy Mountain, Fish and Wildlife, although they've been involved all along, don't have much in the way of concerns. There aren't significant wildlife issues at the site.
Colleagues, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Ian. Okay, I'm going to bring people up in the order in which they signed up, since we have no one who's from over 100 miles or who confessed to be over 100 miles. So Tom Wolfe, Paige Spence, and Marge Easley, please.
Chair Dembro, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with the Trout Unlimited, here representing our 3,200 members in the state and 155,000 nationwide who are dedicated to protecting and preserving wild trout and salmon in their habitat. When Senate Bill 644 came out because of the language, especially about the makeup of the Dogami Board and the section dredge mining part, we were opposed vehemently to the bill. But with the Dash 3, and I have to give credit and kudos to Dave and Rich on their work to address our concerns, and they did a good job on that. And so having run this by my board and the staff members, currently we have a board of 8 people in the state and 22 staff people that we have to run everything by. It gets a little convoluted, but we've looked at it, and we are neutral on it, but we have 2 exceptions to that. Number one is the concerns that ODFW raised on the Goal 5 and on that, because not only on the sage grouse, but the most truly native trout in Oregon is something called the Great Basin Red Band. It's found in southeast Oregon, the Omicus Newberry. It's a rather remarkable fish that can survive in 30-degree winter weather and extreme flows. It can survive in 85-degree temperature waters, and we worry about the impact that mining could have on that. So we would encourage the writers of this bill and ODFW to meet together and take care of their concerns. And we also know that some groups that sometimes we work closely with, both the Farm Bureau and Thousand Friends and some others, have some concern about the land use. And if we would love to have those concerns addressed. But as far as our personal mission goes, we're not a land use group other than the Goal 5 issue. we find that these amendments are very good, and like you said, we certainly understand that the mining industry is a key part of the history of Oregon. Coming from a logging family myself, I understand the history of industry in the state. So right now, as long as our issues with Goal 5 with ODFW are met, Trout Unlimited will be neutral on this. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, committee members. For the record, my name is Paige Spence, and I'm the director of the Oregon Conservation Network. We are a coalition of nearly 40 statewide nonprofit organizations that work to fight policies that threaten our state's natural legacy. We include groups such as Trout Unlimited, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, the Oregon Natural Desert Association, Center for Biological Diversity, Rogue River Keeper, and Native Fish Society. All of those groups have submitted written testimony or are here in person today. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the amendment, the Dash 3. OLCV is opposed to this bill with the Dash 3 amendment. Section 1, Sub 3 of 644-3 revises ORS 215-283, which sets forth all the permitted uses of exclusive farm use zones. And the changes proposed in this section of the Dash 3 amendment would allow mining as an allowable use in 7 of the eastern Oregon counties on land use or land that is zoned exclusive farm use. And the counties would only have the authority to deny the permits, the mining permits, in very limited circumstances. I want to be very clear that the Oregon League of Conservation Voters does not find mining to be an appropriate use of farmland. There is a list of non-farm uses that are allowed on exclusive farm use zone land that we are comfortable with, but they're much more minor. They include dog training, model aircraft flying, which sounds really fun, even though I can't say it, utility facilities and parks. But unlike some of these uses, the impact of mining is just far greater. It removes large quantities of topsoil from the farmland, disrupts large areas, and potentially, you know, has hazardous waste impacts that could take land out of the ability to be farmed for perpetuity. And moreover, we just don't think these provisions are necessary. Mining is already allowed as a conditional use on exclusive farm use land, provided the operations won't force a significant change or increase the cost of accepted farm or forest practices on surrounding lands. And these protections that are set forth in statute already provide assurances that non-farm uses like mining will not undermine the agricultural economy that's so important to Oregon. And we hope that these sideboards that are already in place will continue to be applied to mining projects and provide a balance that allows mining on exclusive farm use zone land only where appropriate. And a separate reason that we urge the committee to oppose 644 with the Dash 3 amendment is, as my colleagues have mentioned, the sage grouse, signature bird of sagebrush habitat in eastern Oregon. And as you all know, the measures that the legislature took in 2015 to fund sage grouse protection were very key in the federal government's 2015 determination that the sage grouse need not be federally listed. That review is up in 2020, are the listings up for review in 2020? And we're afraid that allowing mining in more areas in eastern Oregon could contribute to a listing, which could potentially cost the state a whole lot of money and detrimentally restrict land use in the future. So, in short, thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill.
Great. Thank you, Paige.
Hi, my name is Marge Easley, members of the committee, and Senator Dembro. I am representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I submitted previously testimony relating to the original bill, so I'm revising my comments today to reflect the Dash 3 amendments. We support policies that promote both conservation and development of land as a natural resource in accordance with Oregon's land use goals. These policies are designed to achieve a balance between competing resources by establishing a careful land use review process. We oppose 644 because it makes fundamental changes to these processes, and it tilts the scale to favor mining over other land uses. We oppose provisions in the amendments related to mining in eastern Oregon because we believe these provisions would exempt mining from standards for approval requirements for review and permitting listed in ORS 215-296 that all other counties must follow. And it restricts, this is the primary reason, it restricts the ability of local government to deny applications, elicit citizen input, and impose conditions on conflicts related to transportation, health, or safety. We believe that farming and mining are equally important for the prosperity of our state, but we object to attempts such as this bill that significantly change our land use system by carving out land use exemptions to favor one industry over another. Thank you.
Colleagues, any questions of this panel?
Thank you.
Okay, let's have Bruce Chapin and Marion Nash, please.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, Marianne Nash here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, and specifically wanted to note you have testimony in the record from Grant and Harney County Farm Bureaus, who unequivocally decided to oppose this bill, and also wanted to reflect that Union and Malheur County Farm Bureaus have taken a position against it as well. So I think there's a perception that we often get that Farm Bureau is just West Side farmers, and that's absolutely not true. We have very active Farm Bureaus and Farm Bureau members on the east side that both farm and ranch who are concerned about this bill, primarily because it seems to be specifically designed to eliminate consideration of impacts to agriculture. It changes the standards for setting a mine on farm and ranch land, as we've discussed in several eastern Oregon counties, which means that these mines would be allowed without consideration for impacts to neighboring landowners and to the longstanding uses of the land in the area. And Senator Dembro, I know you noted the statistic that we have. We got statistics from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I will point out specific to these impacted counties. Four of the counties have 100% success rate with applications for aggregate and surface mining. And my understanding, though I don't know which type of application they were, my understanding is that particularly in Baker County, there's been mining for gold that has been happening for quite some time. And so I think that there have been applications. My understanding there is for mining. And then in the three other counties, the approval rates range from 92 to 97%. So our members' feeling is that these are not difficult permits to get. I actually had a rancher come up to me at a reception the other day and say, hey, I sited an aggregate mine on my property and it was really easy. And so I don't know that there is the concern that these permits are so hard to get or so difficult to get when the statistics are showing that they are getting them. But hopefully with appropriate conditions to make sure that there aren't impacts on neighbors, because agriculture has existed in these communities for a very long time and will continue to exist long after mining resources are depleted. So the land use process exists to ensure that farmers and ranchers won't be impacted by proposed mines. None of the other permits received by the mining industry look at these impacts to neighbors or require mitigation of those impacts. So removal or alteration of the conditional use process would eliminate the ability of these neighboring agricultural operations to raise concerns with the potential impacts of the mine or ask for any changes or modifications to the operation to ensure that their farms or ranches are protected. We are more broadly concerned about the Dash 3 amendments creating an entirely new set of definitions, standards, and permitting requirements for mines that counties would have to interpret, do text amendments to adopt. And again, we're asking, why are we doing this when the existing process is already working and working well? And so the long and short, and I want to speak to the right to mine provisions a little bit as well. We support mining, but not at the expense of existing agricultural uses. Universally, I heard from every single county farm bureau in these impacted counties, we want to see more mining. We want to welcome them into their counties. We want the jobs, but we don't want the jobs at the expense of not being able to raise a concern and not being able to talk to our neighbor and have a concern addressed as we have for generations. And that leads to the concerns about the right to mine provisions. Not only would this bill eliminate the ability of neighboring farms and ranches to raise impacts to the land use process, raise concerns about impacts, but then it could also bar them from bringing a nuisance or trespass lawsuit if there was an impact that they didn't get to have addressed through the land use process that may be allowed under the permit that doesn't look at farms and ranches but has an actual impact on them. It is a unique provision or a unique right to mine law in that it doesn't have any of the protections that, for example, right to farm has a protection for damage to commercial agricultural products. So if you have somebody claiming damage, they can bring a trespasser nuisance lawsuit, and this doesn't have that provision. It also seems to change the status of negligence and ultra-hazardous activities, and I'm not quite sure what that means or what that does, but I noted it as something that I thought was unclear to me what it was trying to get at there. So for the right to mine provisions, we think that they're overly broad and that they risk compounding the harm that farms and ranches could experience from not having the land use process that the first part of the bill would take away. So long story short, we heard strongly from folks in these Eastern Oregon counties, in these impacted counties, that they think the existing process is appropriate. They want to keep it as is. They don't think it's overly burdensome or overly difficult to achieve for mining. And in fact, the statistics show that these counties have done a good job of moving these projects forward and granting permits. So with that, I will conclude.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chapin.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, I'm Bruce Chapin. I'm a third-generation farmer farming just north of Salem. Also in the 70s, my father and I sold gravel. It was used to widen the freeway from Woodburn to Salem. So I've had experience in both industries. And I recommend that you not support this bill. Senate Bill 644 started out to be a bill that addresses some specific issues in seven Eastern Oregon counties, and has evolved to a statewide right to mine bill that excessively restricts the right of farmers to be protected from trespass and nuisance by miners. As I read it, Section 2, 3, and 4 applies statewide and to all types of mines. There are legitimate potential conflicts between the two industries, and I encourage the committee not to change the current law, which has been allowing mining while ensuring that impacts to neighboring farms and ranches are taken into account. Current process has not been unfair to the miners. As Marianne alluded to, 96% of the applications since 1996 have been approved, and to my knowledge, all farmer to miner conflicts occurring after the site has been permitted have been resolved without going to court. There's probably some exception to it out there, but I have not heard of it. So the bottom line, the system is working. Now you gotta understand that according to DGAMI, 90% of the aggregate production is controlled by four international companies. And what encourages these out-of-court settlements when you're dealing with giant corporations is the ability to take them to court or the threat of taking to court, but you don't necessarily have to go to court. And if you eliminate that, I do think that agriculture will get walked on. I am concerned also about the wording in the amendment where it states that mining is considered the sole primary use of the property. Well, mining is a consumptive use, causing miners to keep moving onto the other sites and leave the depleted mine behind. So it was a discussion about jobs. Mining doesn't produce jobs indefinitely. It's for a short period of time, unlike Nike or Intel or agriculture. They're moving all the time. Currently, Mayan sites have to be reclaimed back to use that is compatible to the primary use of the zone. In the EFU zone, the primary use is agriculture, and the reclaimed use must be compatible with agriculture. After making mining the sole primary use of that property, how will future uses of the site and future relationship to the surrounding farms be affected? And I ask that you oppose this bill. And thank you for the opportunity to speak here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chapin. Questions? Vice Chair Olson.
I caught this, and I might be wrong, and I want to clarify, Mr. Chapin. You said that mining is a short-term operation?
Correct. Relatively speaking, yes.
Relatively speaking. In Canby, there's been a mine in operation since 1950, and it continues. I would consider that to be more of a long-term operation, and it's been in the same place. And I know many mines, many gravel pits that have been open for a long, 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 long time. So why would you determine that it would be a short-term operation?
There's only so much gravel there that they're mining. And when that gravel is gone, they're going to have to move. It is a consumptive business. What we're seeing in the Mission Bottom area is, my father purchased the old Collard gravel pit. And like I said, he ran it and sold some more gravel out of it, had him go down deeper rather than take any farmland. But then it ran out, or else we would have had to take farmland. Windsor Island, they're running out of rock there, so now they've already got permits to move across the street and take out more farmland. It is moving all the time. You can't mine the same rock more than once, or the same truckload of rock more than once. In time, it does become depleted.
Let me ask you, as you know, we heard there's an intent, and I'm not sure I agree with you, I'm not sure the dash threes really get there, but to restrict this to the east side counties and to have it not include aggregate and gravel, that kind of thing. In the areas where you can envision the mining happening now, what kind of agriculture is happening on those lands? Marianne?
So, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I had this conversation actually yesterday. When I had my county farm bureaus take a position on it, I had them just take a position on mining. They all said if aggregates in the bill were showing up, because that is much more of a aggregate resource than the farm resource are in the exact same place. A lot of them did look at the map and say, historical mine sites, a lot of that's more of the rangeland. There were a couple that they were saying it's getting into some actual, whether it's vegetable or hay farming. Areas, and so that was, they were just saying, well, this process exists so that if there is a resource there, because as I was told yesterday, those are the historic sites that are actually marked in that map that's in the Dogami report, and then there's just mineral potential maps, and so nobody really knows, I think, where all of the deposits are. I think our folks looked at the map and said, okay, historically, hopefully a lot of it's been away from some of the more active farming or more intensive farming areas and much more into rangeland. But that said, our Farm Bureau President in Harney County is a rancher, and he said, well, man, if it was right up against my calving barn, I'd want an ability to say something. I want an ability to say, can we agree on some operational restrictions that would mitigate the impact on, brand new calves from what could potentially cause low birth weight and other issues. And so I think that's for us, we don't really know. And so we want the committee to be just still allow us the tool, especially because the tool has proven successful. And particularly, I think Baker's a very mining resource intensive county. They've had 100% success rate permitting aggregate and mining operations. And so for us, we're saying the current process is working. Why eliminate our ability to raise those concerns with our new neighbors and work out something that could actually mitigate the results and make sure both can still be successful? Why are we not having any voice now anywhere in the process? And so that's where the primary feedback I was getting was coming from, is we hope it's not right where we want to be, but it could be, and we want to be able to raise those concerns, and even within rangeland there can be impacts.
Great. Any other questions? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Chapin, thanks for coming in. Okay, our last panel, we have Kathy McDonald, please. And is Mary Kyle here? Oh, yeah. You look different, Mary.
Mary's changed.
Maybe that's happy. He's happy. He's not Mary. He's happy.
Kathy, you want to start?
Thank you. Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Kathy McDonald. I'm the Director of External Affairs and Policy for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon. And I'm pleased to be here to testify on Senate Bill 644. For the past 6 years, I worked very closely with the state of Oregon, local elected officials and land use planners and federal agencies to help the state build the All Lands, All Threats Sage-Grouse Action Plan. And I was one of the key provisions in that action plan was some increased regulatory assurances around land uses. Sage-grouse are very sensitive to disturbance and noise, and so one of the, even though Oregon has such great land use laws, all of the parties felt that it was really important to even strengthen them further to provide those regulatory assurances so Oregon could keep control over land use and land management associated with the sage-grouse. I was on both rules committees, both the DLCD and ODFW rules committees, on to set up those stronger protections. And preliminary conversations with DLCD staff, also involved in those rules, was that this could circumvent the new land use rules and the requirements to meet the compensatory mitigation program. And I think you heard earlier that the agencies, including Dogami, have some, you know, there's some uncertainty around exactly how these provisions would affect those new rules. So I would just encourage the committee to get the agencies together to really be able to do a thorough assessment of the potential impacts on the sage-grouse protections and the action plan moving forward. We tried in the rulemaking to find a balance that provided for some opportunities for economic development, even in the most sensitive habitats for sage-grouse. And we worked hard together to come up with something that the county's county planners and conservation interests, agricultural interests, thought was good. So I would just echo that we have a good process in place, and I have concerns that this might impact it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Mary Kyle.
Good afternoon, Senator Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roger Kay, not Mary Kyle McCurdy, and I am current president of Friends of Marin County. Unfortunately, Mary Kyle was tied up in another meeting and couldn't make it, and she asked me to represent her testimony. But I'm going to read our testimony from Friends of Marin County, and both our testimony and 1,000 Friends has been submitted and is available on your website. Our organization, Friends of Marin County, is a 501c3 farmland protection organization founded in 1998. Our mission is to protect farm, forest land, parks, and open space. Our organization and its individual members are opposed to SB 644 and requested no vote, since this bill would have a major negative change to our land use system. There are many reasons that we oppose this bill, and I'll just list a few. Number one, farming and ranching are hugely important industries in eastern Oregon. They will be negatively impacted by this bill. SB 644 would allow mining on eastern Oregon farmland and no land use, with no land review at all and no permit. Counties would have no ability to limit or mitigate the impacts of mining on surrounding farmers and ranching operations. This effectively turns a farmland zone into a farmland and mining zone. Number two, existing protections of farmland in eastern Oregon should not be traded away for this suction dredge bill. Eastern Oregon farming should be protected consistent with statewide land use goal 3. And number three, mining can be a compatible use with farming and ranching, but sometimes it is not. That is why the current law protects farmland but allows mining as a conditional use on farmland. And SB 644 is ill-conceived and a real threat to Oregon's landscape. We therefore request a no vote on this measure. And thank you for your consideration. In terms of 1,000 Friends' testimony, I think it goes into some of the same points that I mentioned. However, it's more detailed and more exact in terms of what ORS it affects. So if you take a, I'm sorry she could not be here. If you take a peek at her written testimony, it'll be more detailed and more explanatory of our position.
We certainly will.
Thank you.
Any questions of this panel, colleagues? Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, is there anyone else here who didn't have a chance to sign up who wanted to speak to Senate Bill 644? Okay, seeing none. We'll have some conversations about next steps for this bill and get back to you. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 644. Thank you to all who came and testified on it. Colleagues, we are adjourned for this week.
You sure you don't have a meeting tonight?
This week.
You sure you don't have a meeting tonight?